working.
Oh,
so
it's from there?
The new video system uses this camera here, and it also records the screen. So right now it's recording myself with like, several repetitions, but now I'll turn it off, and now it will be recording, or not, I minimized it, and now it will be recording me as the lower half, and the screen as the upper half, but directly from the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a, okay. Anyway, so let me remind you where we were, and it's actually also a review. I think it was sort of, it's worth repeating. It's kind of intricate, okay? Let me remind you where we were, and then we'll move a little bit forward, not too much because, well, there isn't that much time today. But anyway, so we were studying the Lie algebra G epsilon, which is the Lie algebra generated by H, E, L, and F, subject to the commutation relations written here. At epsilon equals to zero, if you drop it, it's just G0 that we've been studying for a while. And it has a lowercase r matrix, meaning a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation. And here it is written, and later today we will verify that it works. So, I mean, for now, just believe me that it works. And at some point, I think I mentioned that there is a theorem that whenever there is a solution of the classical Young-Baxter equation, there is a solution of the global Young-Baxter equation. So therefore, there is an invariant associated with this algebra. The only question is, how do you compute it? Okay? Now, as we noticed last time, at finite epsilon, so, you know, I use the multiplicative sense of the word finite. So when people talk multiplicatively, finite means not infinity and not zero. Okay? So at finite epsilon, this Lie algebra is isomorphic to SL2. Sorry, GL2. Because, well, here's the isomorphism, and we verified it. So basically, H goes to -1, -1, E goes to 0, 0, minus epsilon 0, L goes to some, not terrible mess, but somewhat of a mess, and F goes to 0, 1, 0, 0, and you can check that these satisfy the same commutation relations. By the way, the fact that this is somewhat messy, and the fact that this is negative the identity instead of the identity, and the fact that this is negative epsilon instead of epsilon, sort of suggests that I've chosen the wrong basis. So at some point I will switch to the right basis, but it's not urgent and it's not important. It will be a minor point at some point. Okay? Now, the fact that this Lie algebra is isomorphic to GL2 at finite epsilon also tells you roughly where it came from, and suggests that there are more like it, and in fact there are more like it. I mean, the suggestion is actually true, okay? Namely, how did it come about? The main thing that happened, so ignoring the diagonal, the main thing that happened is that we took one of the lower diagonal part of the lower triangular part of GL2, and we could have done the same for GLN, and multiplied it by epsilon, multiplied the generators by epsilon. And then the amusing thing that happens is that when you write the commutation relations in this new basis, they make sense at epsilon goes to zero. The basis itself does not make sense as epsilon goes to zero, because, well, this blows up, and this becomes zero, and zero does, is not a basis, is not a vector in a basis, okay? However, the commutation relations do make sense as epsilon goes to zero. So sort of the isomorphism with GL2 breaks down. But the Lie algebra doesn't. But the formal Lie algebra doesn't. So I think I wanted to kind of draw a picture of it, okay? So, and I left a little space for that. So here is the space of all Lie algebras, this. Or more precisely, it's the variety of Lie, of 4D Lie algebras. So what is the variety of 4D Lie algebras? So every 4D Lie algebra is a subset, is a choice of structure constants on a four-dimensional vector space. So take V, which is a four-dimensional vector space, and then structure constants is an operation that goes from V tensor V into V. So it's an element in V dual tensor V dual tensor V, and I think this comes out to be like 64 dimensional, 4 cubed. Okay? Now, to be a Lie algebra, so this is a 64 dimensional space, but to be a Lie algebra, you need to satisfy two things. You need to satisfy antisymmetry, which is sort of trivial, it just cuts the dimension by, I don't want to think even. And then the Jacobi identity, the Jacobi relation. And the Jacobi relation is quadratic in the structure constants, right? It's, you apply the bracket twice in order to write the Jacobi identity. So this is a certain quadratic variety inside a certain big affine space, okay? Now, this quadratic variety is divided into chunk, or, well, if you want, there is an action on it of the automorphism group of V, and it divides it into orbits. Said differently, so this is the variety of Lie algebras, and it is divided into chunks according to which abstract Lie algebra it is isomorphic to. So somewhere here, there is the Lie algebra zero, meaning the bracket is equal to zero, which makes it the abelian Lie algebra, and it's a single individual point, okay? The group acts on it trivially. Somewhere else here, there is the standard definition of GL2. So this will be GL2, okay? Now, there is a theorem that GL2 is rigid. So if you deform GL2 a little bit, what you get is isomorphic to GL2. So GL2 is in the interior of its own chamber within this variety as subdivided into orbits. Okay? So it's sort of in the interior of its own orbit. In fact, that meaning the orbit of Lie algebras that are isomorphic to GL2 is open. Okay? Yet we can take a curve which is a function of epsilon which goes to the boundary, and then on the boundary here there is a Lie algebra, and that Lie algebra on the boundary is G0. And if you move epsilon away from it, so you get something that's isomorphic to GL2, but I call it G epsilon because it's GL2 with a non-standard basis and with structure constants that converge to the structure constants of G0 as epsilon goes to zero. So that's sort of the image I have. It didn't add any information, this story, but it's still nice to have it. Okay? So sort of what's happened. Oh! And maybe another point, I think, Stefan, you asked about quantum groups.
Yeah.
So quantum groups is something else. Quantum groups, okay, quantum groups are not Lie algebras, they are algebras. But that's not a big deal. Every Lie algebra is embedded inside its universal enveloping algebra, so a quantum group is a deformation of the universal enveloping algebra. But not a deformation of the Lie algebra itself. It's not a Lie algebra. So quantum GL2. So if you want, you can think that this variety lives inside a bigger space. It also lives inside the bigger space of associative algebras, and sort of within that bigger space, sort of you move perpendicularly, you move away from GL2 in a direction that's not on the board right now, and then you get quantum GL2. And we're doing something else. We're
okay. Yeah. Does that give us a deformation of the universal enveloping algebra G0 then? The quantum?
So that's an excellent question, and I would expect that the whole quantum construction, and in fact Roland has a lot in that direction. You see, he's listening, so I should at least. So there is also a deformation of G0, and there might be different deformations of other things, I don't know, or some other things, I don't know. And it's possible that, well, since many knot invariants are written in terms of QGL2, so like going perpendicularly, it's possible that, you know, a year from now, when we are smarter, we will also describe G0 by first going perpendicularly. But at least to me, I'm not ready to do it yet. Okay? Anyway, Okay, so that's chapter one of my preliminary notes for today. And here is chapter two. So, okay, the point, as always in this subject, is to be able to rewrite quadratics or exponentials, or reorder the base, using a new normal ordering of, using a new ordering of the PDW ordering for the universal enveloping algebra. Sorry, I got confused with language. And I claim that in G epsilon, in fact, not even in G0 or G1, in G epsilon, so in G epsilon, if you want to order in the order FE, so I started writing the order before the function, the specification before the polynomial, but it doesn't, for no real reason, okay? So if you start from an incorrectly ordered exponential, and I'm doing the FE because FE is the hardest, and again, it's an exponential of something quadratic in ENF, because that's what I care about. These are the things that you will get, okay? And if you reorder it to Elf order, the formula for the result is nu times lambda times the same exponential of a quadratic as we had last time, sorry, as we had for G0. So basically, it's the same formula as for G0, with the only change that we add a factor lambda, or lambda sub epsilon. So lambda is the what we call the logos, because it has all the information in it, and logos in Greek is what is logos in Greek? I'm always forgetting. A principle of order and knowledge. So it kind of has everything you need to know in it, but the point in it is that it's a power series in epsilon. So for high powers of epsilon, it's a total absolute mess, but at each individual epsilon, it's a rational function in all the relevant variables. So the generators of the Lie algebra, and the coefficients alpha, beta, gamma. So it's a rational function in these variables, and in fact it's a rational function whose denominator comes from only one place, so it's very easy to say what it is. So it's really a polynomial once you factor out the easy denominator. So it's really like a polynomial, well, many variables, but it's a polynomial of a finite degree. So basically, you can write it explicitly, you know what it is, and you're done. And not you're done, and you know how to commute things. Okay? So, but now I want to remind you how the logos was derived. Okay? In fact, that's not how it was derived the first time, but this is how it was derived like 2 weeks ago. Okay? So, because, well, it's sort of messy computation, but very short at the end of the day. So let me go through the derivation again. Okay? So first of all, in GL2, you have that if you want to write the exponential of alpha f times the exponential of beta e in the order e first and then f, and then in the middle actually, or then really the commutator of e and f is h minus 2 epsilon l. So really, you should be you should be getting terms proportional to h minus 2 epsilon l. And you can choose where to put them. You can put them at the beginning, you can put them at the end. Basically, the commutator of h minus 2 epsilon l, so h commutes, h is central, so you don't see it, and the commutator with l just gives you e's and f's back again. So you can move it to the beginning or to the end at the cost of further e's and f's, and what we choose is to put it in the middle. So I want to, where is it? Here. So if I want to write alpha e to the alpha f times e to the beta e as e to the ae, e to the c times this annoying thing, e to the bf, then the coefficients a, b, and c are given by these relatively simple-minded formulas, which are functions of alpha, beta, and epsilon. Okay? And I found these formulas by brute force, but it's not that much brute force, it's just matrix multiplication of 2x2 matrices. So it's an exponentiation of 2x2 matrices. It's not a big deal. Okay? Anyway, okay, so this I know. And now, this means that the ordered exponential of, in the order Fe, of alpha F plus beta E, I mean, this is just the left-hand side, is the ordering in the order ELF of the form of alpha E plus BF, sorry, AE plus BF plus CH minus 2 epsilon L, where A, B, and C are given by this formula. That's just the right-hand side. Okay? And right, and what do they do here? Right, and oh, right, and on the other hand, I know that at epsilon goes to that at epsilon equals to zero. You get the formula that we got for G0, and of course we could rederive it simply by substituting epsilon, by taking the limit as epsilon goes to zero in these coefficients. I mean, so I could rederive it, but it's also the formula we already know. So at epsilon equals to zero, you get e to the alpha f plus beta e minus alpha beta h. And at epsilon, and then at other epsilon, you get some power series of alpha and beta in epsilon, which I will call lambda epsilon of alpha and beta. So, I mean, basically what I did is I took this thing and I expanded it as a power series in epsilon, and basically around epsilon equals to zero. And basically, since it's an exponential, the result is that same exponential times a power series. So Right, because differentiating an exponential with respect to epsilon, you always get the same exponential, but with coefficients. So if you write the Taylor expansion, you'll always get the exponential that you get at epsilon equals to zero, but then you get a power series of coefficients. But then the next thing to note is that whenever you have a polynomial in alpha and beta or a power series in alpha and beta, you can write it, you can replace alpha by the derivative with respect to f and beta by the derivative with respect to e. So instead of writing it as a polynomial in alpha and beta, you can write it as a polynomial in the derivative with respect to f and the derivative with respect to e, acting on this. Basically, because the derivative with respect to f pulls down an alpha and the derivative with respect to e pulls down a beta. Okay? Okay. So given that, okay, so now I know how to reorder plane exponentials. And as I told you before, once you know how to reorder plane exponentials, you know how to reorder anything. But let's actually perform this. So if you try to reorder, well, what I really care about are exponentials, well, alpha f plus beta e plus delta e f, we're basically adding a quadratic term. So I want to reorder this from the order f e to the order l. And the old trick was to replace the delta EF by e to the delta del alpha del beta acting on this exponential, then pull the differential operator outside the ordering, and then inside the ordering you have the formula we already know, and then push it back in. So basically the result is that this is, in elf ordering, you take the differential operator delta del alpha del beta acting on this, which is exactly what I wrote here. Okay? But now, these two differential operators commute. This one has dfs and de's, and this one has only del alphas and del betas, so they commute. Wait, did I blunder? I mean, oh yeah, they commute, right, sorry. I thought, wait, but doesn't lambda have alphas and betas in it as well? I mean, if it had alphas and betas, it wouldn't commute with differentiation with respect to this. But no, it doesn't, because that was the point. I've replaced the alphas and betas by differentiation. So it no longer has alphas and betas. So they commute, and then I get e to the Laplacian acting on this, but this we computed in the case of G0 using the heat equation. Again, now I'm using big words, it's using the heat equation, but at the end it was a one-line verification. You just check that it satisfies the right differential equation. So you get, so this thing with that gives this thing, and I still have the lambda differential operator acting on it, right? But now, if I take a differential operator and apply it to an exponential, I just get the same exponential multiplied by a polynomial. Except, it's for every so really this is lambda epsilon is a power series in epsilon, each of whose coefficients is a polynomial differential operator. So upper lambda epsilon will be a power series in epsilon, each of whose coefficients will be a polynomial in all the variables that can occur, and since one of these variables is nu, which has a denominator, I'm stuck with a rational function. So that's what we did last time, and it's the key to commuting. I mean, once we know this lambda, and we just need to know it once and for all. I could write the formula, and you could verify it, and it doesn't matter if it came from a complicated computation. The moment we have this formula, we know how to commute. So it really doesn't matter if it came from somewhere complicated like this. In fact, this isn't complicated. This is just one blackboard. Okay? Anyway, I want to go through the implementation. So, okay. Okay. So within the implementation, I will end up several times needing to, take a polynomial in some variables and rewrite it and turn it into a differential operator. It turns out that Mathematica doesn't have a built-in program to do it, so I had to write it. Okay? Now, it's only one line of code, two lines, I suppose. Is this visible or should I make it larger? Okay. So it's only two lines of code, but I still have to go through it. So, if I was aiming for full generality, I would have written a routine that takes arbitrarily many variables and turns it into a polynomial in arbitrarily many different derivatives. But we're lucky, and we only need the case of two. Okay, we need to take two variables and convert them into differentiations. And that's the only thing we will ever need. So I just wrote it in the case of two. So here is the definition. The differential polynomial defined by the polynomial P, in which you make the substitution x goes to the derivative with respect to alpha, and y goes to the derivative with respect to beta. But you see, x and y and alpha and beta and p are arbitrary patterns. So, I mean, I will later be able to use them with different variable names. Applied to the function f is defined as follows. Okay? So, I need to, first of all, analyze the polynomial P as a polynomial in these two variables, x and y. So Mathematica doesn't have this operation, but it has several operations to look into, to look inside polynomials. So for example, one of the operations is I could do coefficient of x plus y cubed, and suppose I wanted to know the coefficient of x y squared. So anybody knows what it is?
Three.
Good. Will Mathematica tell us that it's three? Yay! Okay. But, you know, there is another thing, and this is, I can do coefficient list, I believe it's called. So this will give me the list of coefficient of this, say with respect to x. So the list of coefficients will be the coefficient of x to the 0 is 1, the coefficient of x to, no, it's y cubed. the coefficient of x is as, well, let's see, here it is. Okay? I could also do coefficient, the list of coefficients with respect to both x and y, and now I will get an array, and probably the best is to print this array as a matrix, and well, okay, I mean, you know x plus y cubed, so there's nothing exciting here. And then the last thing I could do, or not the last, but one other thing that I could do is to do the coefficient rules. And that's somehow the most compact representation of the output. So the power 3,0 has coefficient 1. The power 2,1 has coefficient 3. 1,2 is 3,0. It's clear, right? It's clear what it does. And this is relative to the variables x and y. So the first thing I do is I compute the coefficient rule of p relative to x and y. And that this gives me a list of rules in which every rule is of the form mn going to c, where m and n are the powers of x and y, and c is the coefficient. Okay? So, for example, I could take this list of rules and apply to it the rule that wherever you see, let me just copy it, wherever you see mn goes to c, you replace it by t for Travis to the power m, v for Juan to the power for Vo, sorry. For Juan it would be h. H for Juan to the power n, and multiplied by the coefficient c. Okay? And then what do I get? I get the list of things. So Travis cubed, 3 Juan Travis squared, and so on. Okay? Sorry, I hope you don't mind me using your names. I hope you're not insulting. I'm not using your name. I'll get to it.
So it has a. So you can just replace all these with the correct differentiation. So it knows how to do that much, but it doesn't know on its own how to make it like.
Wait, I'm not done. This is still a list, but now I need to apply to it the operator total. Basically, total of a list sums the elements in a list, and now I wrote in the worst possible way the change of variables xy to th. Okay, now I do what Stefan suggested. So instead of writing here c to the m h to the n, I write c times the mth derivative of f with respect to alpha, the nth derivative of f with respect to beta. That's it. So differentiation exists. It's only that it doesn't know how to substitute derivations into polynomials. And if you want to check differentiation on the side, we can do it. I mean, so the derivative of I think we've done it before.
Yeah, when we originally started replacing stuff with differentials.
Yeah. Right, but anyway, so the differentiation exists. The only issue is to substitute the derivative into an operator. So anyway, so that's the full program. Okay, so let me enter it, and now let me test it. So okay, so now I'm applying the. As a test, right? Oh, you can cheat because it's on your note in your handout, right? But don't, okay? Or pretend not to. So basically, if I take a polynomial and replace x and y by differentiation with respect to alpha and beta, so each differentiation with respect to alpha becomes a u. which means that X's becomes U's, and Y's likewise become, well, Y's become differentiations with respect to beta. Beta is multiplies V, so Y becomes V. So this will just pull a U cubed plus V cubed, sorry, U plus V cubed out of the exponential, and well, and that's a very silly way to write a polynomials, but I mean, here it is. Okay. So now, now that I have this, I can complete the computation of the logos. Okay, so here, first of all, here is the hard way. So D stands for hard, which I replace by detailed. Okay, so now I want to find the logos polynomial to degree k. So k here, actually, here I wrote epsilon as a function of epsilon, but in the program k means to which power of epsilon am I computing? And this polynomial is I call it a polynomial, it's really a rational function. So this rational function is really a function of seven arguments, H, E, L, F, alpha, beta, and delta. And to find it, I write a module. A module is just something which is allowed to have local variables, because I want to use many local variables. The local variables are the representation of H, representation of E, basically all of these, and these are taken from the blackboard, but also from verifications we did before. And then I write the equation. So the equation is matrix exponential of alpha times F times matrix exponential of beta times E. Basically, I write this equation. This is EQN. So, you know, this in the program becomes EQN. And then I tell the computer to solve this equation. And if you remember, there was this annoying issue that the equation involves an e to the 2 pi I k, and k gets called c of 1, so I just declare that c of 1 goes to 0. So this is, and finally I ask the computer to echo the solution. Echo just prints. Echo is just a name for print. Okay? So I'm printing the solution. This is an intermediate printout. It's an annoying thing. If you run a large computation and it prints out into many intermediate things, it's annoying. But I want to do it just once, okay? So I echo the solution, and it should echo these formulas, right? And then I define lambda to be. So what was lambda here? Lambda is, you take this thing, you expand it as a power series in epsilon, and the result should be this thing times lambda. So in other words, I divide by this thing and I get lambda. So lambda is, I take the power, I take this thing, which is exactly that. I replace A, B, and C by whatever the solution says they are. I write it as a power series in epsilon to degree k. I convert it into, so power series have a funny internal representation. I don't know, should I show you? Maybe, I mean, why not? I mean, so if you just do, I don't know, series of, e to the power x, x goes at x at 0 and to order 5, you get what you expect, but you get plus O of x to the 6. This O of x to the 6 I want to drop. So if I do this series and convert it to normal, so apply the operation normal to it, the only thing it does is it drops the O of x to the 6. So that's why I did this normal here, and then I divide by this, by multiplying by its inverse, and simplify the result. So this is lambda. And finally, what is uppercase lambda? So uppercase lambda is, you take lambda, turn it into a differential operator, apply it to this formula here, which I may as well call Q, and then delete Q, so multiply by Q inverse. So Q is this, and wait, what happened to the nu? Oh, nu has no e's and f's in it, so I can ignore it. So q is just this, and this nu cancels that nu. So I can just ignore it for finding lambda. Okay? So I take lambda, turn it into a differential operator, apply it to q, multiply by q inverse, this gives me uppercase lambda, and then I replace nu by what it should be, so 1 over 1 plus h delta, and then the rest is I collect it in powers of epsilon and simplify the result. Okay? So, if you don't believe, so let's enter it. And here is 2k equals 1. So 2k equals 1, okay, first of all, here is the intermediate printing, and A becomes this, B becomes this, C becomes this, and the reason it's $384 is because that's how Mathematica represents local variables. So A is really a local variable of this module, And the way Mathematica localizes variables is by changing their name to unique names by adding dollar integer. So that's just the local name for A, B, and C. And if you look at these formulas, they are the same as the formulas written here. And in fact, there is a very clear reason to it, and the reason is that I've copied these formulas from there. Okay? And finally, this is the logos. Again, it's horrible and messy, but you know, it's not, but it does what it needs to do, and it came from this is the logos to degree 1, but I could have equally well computed it to degree whatever you say. Well, you know, it grows very rapidly, so I'll only do it to degree 2. And even this takes time. Why does it take time, by the way? Because simplify is extremely inefficient. The command simplify looks in a huge space of possibilities for what's the simplest way to write something. Had I not written simplify, it would have been much faster. But anyway, this is the logos for k equals 2. But again, it doesn't really matter. Right? I mean, it's okay. Anyway, and by the way, finally, the program for the logos could be vastly simplified. Namely, all of this, this is the detailed logos. I didn't really need to find these matrices and write the equation and solve it. I already know what the solution is. Okay? So, basically, I could have started right away from lambda is equal to the power series of this quantity where A, B, and C are replaced by their true values. And that just comes out to be this horrible formula. And then you write some power series, and then the rest is the same. Okay? So, and by the way, had I told you that this polynomial, this function plays a role in computing knot invariants, you wouldn't have been, you know, you would have told me I'm crazy. Anyway, so this is the simplest formula for definition of the logos. And in fact, if you think of it, the program that generates the logos is logos is actually shorter than the logos. But anyway, so just check that the two are the same, and they are. And by the way, okay, since the math here was so complicated, you have no reason to believe it. On the other hand, we have the tools to test it. So let's test it. So this is happening in a different notebook, and Mathematica has a command for opening another notebook. So let's execute this command, and this opens the other notebook, which is also a handout that you have. And here is testing the logos. So, okay. So basically, the testing program, okay, a few things. First of all, if you look in the evaluation menu and go to the notebook's kernel, you'll see that I've changed it to an alternate kernel. It's not the normal Mathematica kernel, but a second one. So the computations that I do here are happening on a different machine, so they don't interrupt the computations we did before. So in particular, so then I also have to redefine, repeat the definition. So here is differential polynomial again, here is the definition of the logos again, and then here is the implementation of G epsilon, and with it's exactly the same implementations that we did before, I just copied it, everything is exactly the same. But you see, since we have this implementation, here is an aside. I promised you that we will check that this indeed satisfies Chide, the classical Young-Baxter equation. So let's test it. So Rij, okay, so Rij is defined to be, okay, H times or L, so that's just, where is it? Hi and then Lj, and then minus epsilon Lij plus Eifj, okay? So you set Rij to be this, and then you compute the bracket, the sum of the three brackets that make the Chibe equation, the infinitesimal Rademeister 3 equation, and, well, it's zero as it should be. So now we know that there should be a knot invariant. And then, there is a degree rule that I have to use. So basically, everything is graded and things have different degrees. And, you know, I could remind you what the degrees are. So H is degree 1, E is degree 1, L and F are degree 0. And then to make it consistent, epsilon must be given the same degree as H, so degree 1. And finally, alpha and beta, alpha has degree 1 because alpha really is going to be whatever multiplies F, which is a combination of E's. So it's the same degree as E. So that's the degree rule, and now I can just start working. So set k to be 1, declare the target degree, this is now the h-bar degree, to be 6, clear epsilon, remove whatever definition it had, and declare that epsilon to the k plus 1 is equal to 0, and then compute the left-hand side in the FE order, and subtract the right-hand side in which you have inserted the logos and write it in the ELF order, where the left-hand side was in the FE order. So basically, this is now a computation in the universal enveloping algebra, and it takes a little while, and it works. Now you can do the same for k equals 2 and for k equals 3, and you need to go to a higher and higher degree to convince yourself that that you've checked. And everything works, but I will not show you because it takes a real long time. I don't know, do you allow me to go another 3 minutes over time? Okay. Because, well, we're way behind, but... So, here is something amusing. When I did this, I actually... So, I'm showing you kind of the baked result, okay? But when I do these things for myself, you know, I first compute the left-hand side, then I compute the right-hand side. They're not equal because I had a typo in one of them. I correct the typo, I do it again. They're still not equal because of something else. But when I was doing this, I noticed something really weird. And I want to show you this weird thing, and I want to ask you, why do you think it happened? So let me execute it. So I'm doing the k equals 2 logos to degree 8, and I'm asking it to print the left-hand side, but also the timing it took to compute, and the right-hand side, and also the timing it took to compute, and then the difference between the two. So, the difference between the two is 0. The left-hand side, well, came out to be a messy formula. I don't care what it is. The right-hand side is also a messy formula. I mean, the difference between them is 0. But the time for the left-hand side was way more than the time for the right-hand side, even though the right-hand side is way more complicated than the left-hand side. The left-hand side is simply an exponential, and the right-hand side has the logos inside it. So it's rational functions, the differentiations, multiplied by polynomials. So why did the right-hand side, why was the right-hand? So I was puzzled. For like a few minutes, I thought, I have a serious bug in my program. Something can't be right. So why is it?
Riddle. Did it use some of the result on the left-hand side?
No. No. There is no... None of these programs kind of learns from experience, the way I wrote them. No. It's a good answer, or else I wouldn't be wasting your time. Okay. That was the whole point of the logos. In other words, look, this is written in the elf order. And the elf order is the order we use for representing things in the universal enveloping algebra. So the moment the O program expands this polynomial, and that's not a big deal to expand the polynomial. This is commutative operations. These are commutative operations. So the moment it expands this polynomial, and this takes little time, it produces an output, and it's in elf order, so it doesn't need to simplify. Whereas the first program produces the output in the FE order, and then it has to commute all the Fs across all the E's to bring them to elf order, and that takes a long time. Every time you have a bunch of Fs and you're commuting them across a bunch of E's, there's an exponential amount of work to do. At least if you do it stupidly, and this is what the program does. So that was the whole point of the logos. It was to save time. I mean, okay, so this isn't really the real saving. The real saving is that it happens at sort of formula level. But even at the after expansion, these are simpler things. Okay, so I was hoping to do more. We're actually not yet done with the invariant of G1. But, well, we will continue on Tuesday. And this is time to stop and...